He told me I was crazy, and I believed him, until the blackouts got longer, until I woke up in places I didn't remember going, until I found the hidden cameras, the pills I wasn't supposed to question, and the video of my husband drugging me in my sleep. The Lie Inside Me is a chilling psychological thriller told from the mind of a woman who's been manipulated, medicated, and monitored, all by the man she trusted most. But when she stops taking the pills, she stops playing the role. And what she uncovers isn't just gaslighting, it's a plan to erase her. Now it's her turn to rewrite the ending. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you The Lie Inside Me. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Missing Hour. They always say trust your gut. But what do you do when your gut betrays you? When you start to wonder if your instincts are just another lie your mind tells you. Something fabricated in the rotting space between your thoughts, something stitched together with frayed memory and false comfort. What if you don't know what's real anymore? What if you wake up, and you're not where you remember falling asleep? That's where it started again, with the not remembering. I'd been in the kitchen rinsing dishes. I remember the water was too hot. Steam rising up in little ghostly spirals, blurring the window over the sink. I remember the smell of lemon soap, the feel of a plate slipping under my fingers. I remember David behind me, humming something tuneless as he scrubbed down the stovetop. I remember asking him what time it was. He didn't answer. I blinked. Then I was in bed, just like that, like a film reel skipping, cutting out the middle of the scene. The lights were off. The bedroom was freezing. My mouth tasted metallic and dry, like I'd bitten down on a battery. The sheets were tucked tight around me, almost too tight, as if someone had arranged me like a doll. And the clock on my nightstand, black, sleek, unforgiving, flashed 3:12 a.m. over and over, like a heartbeat trying to warn me. And David wasn't beside me. I sat up. The first thing I noticed was the silence. The kind that doesn't feel peaceful, but loaded, like the house was holding its breath. Even the creak of the wood beneath me as I shifted felt too loud. I touched my forehead. Sweaty. My hands shaky. My legs numb like they didn't belong to me. Something was wrong. I knew it deep in my chest. Not in a panicky way. Not like an alarm bell. No, this was cold. Heavy. A quiet dread that settled behind my ribs like a brick in wet cement. I slid out of bed and padded down the hallway. No lights. No glow from the bathroom. No sound from the guest room, where David kept his old records and work papers. And no sign of David. I walked downstairs one step at a time, cringing at every creak. The air was thick, like I was wading through invisible syrup. The living room was pristine. The throw pillows were arranged exactly as I'd left them that afternoon. The lamp in the corner was on, casting a dim yellow haze over the armchair. The coffee table was clear, except for my wine glass. Only it was empty, and I could have sworn it had been half full when I left the kitchen. My pulse picked up. The kitchen was even more surreal. Everything was spotless. Gleaming. The counters, the sink, the stovetop. No sign of dishes. No soap bubbles. No sponge. No David. His keys weren't in the bowl by the door. His coat wasn't on the hook. His shoes weren't by the mat. Gone. He'd left. I didn't remember hearing the garage. Or the front door. Or anything. But he was gone. And I had no idea when he'd left. And worse, no idea how I'd ended up in bed. I told myself I'd just zoned out. That I'd maybe fallen asleep. And he'd carried me up. But that didn't explain the missing dishes, the empty wine glass, the flawless kitchen. And it didn't explain the drawer. The drawer I never touched. It was half open. Subtle. Like it was holding its breath, waiting to be noticed. I don't know what made me go to it. Maybe instinct. Maybe dread. Maybe the faintest trace of lavender and vinegar that didn't belong there. I pulled it open. Inside were three amber pill bottles. Unlabeled but neatly arranged. Each one had a tiny white sticker on the cap with David's looping handwriting. Morning. Night. Extra. No pharmacy name. No dosage. No instructions. I opened the night bottle. Inside were tiny pale pink pills. Odorless. Smooth. Manufactured. I didn't recognize them. And that scared me more than anything else. I should have known. I should have remembered. If I'd been taking them, nightly, shouldn't there be some awareness? Some sense of routine? Some taste on my tongue or foggy memory of swallowing them down? But there was nothing. Just that cold blank space. I put the bottle back. Closed the drawer quietly. My heartbeat was so loud in my ears, I thought it might wake the neighbors. I didn't sleep. I sat on the couch and waited. curled up under the throw blanket with my knees to my chest like a child hiding from a storm. At 4:47 a.m., the garage door opened. David came in, footsteps slow and steady. Coat still zipped, his face unreadable. He didn't see me right away. He moved through the kitchen like he knew exactly where everything was. Because of course he did. He opened the fridge, poured a drink, water maybe, or something clear. Then his eyes landed on me. "You're up," he said softly, voice like silk. I blinked slowly. Couldn't sleep. He walked over and crouched beside me, hand on my knee. His eyes searched mine like he was scanning for fractures. "You forgot your pill tonight." It wasn't a question. I didn't answer. "I'll bring it to you now," he said, standing. "You'll feel better after. I promise." He always says that, and I always believe him. But this time, I reached out and grabbed his wrist before he could walk away. "Where were you?" He smiled, soft and indulgent. "Just clearing my head. You've been worried again. I needed some air." I stared at him. He kissed my forehead. "Don't worry, sweetheart," he whispered. "You're okay now. I'm here." I let go and watched him walk to the kitchen. He didn't go to the drawer. He went to the cabinet above the sink, opened it, took out a new glass. Then from his pocket, he pulled a single pink pill, dropped it in the glass. My stomach turned. He brought it to me. "Just drink it," he said gently. "For me." I took the glass in my hands, held it, smiled. Then when he turned to go upstairs, I quietly poured it into the plant beside the couch. I didn't take anything that night, and I didn't sleep. But for the first time in weeks, maybe months, I felt awake. And I knew one thing for sure. I couldn't trust David. Not anymore. Chapter 2, A Quiet Rebellion. They say tapering off medication is dangerous. You're not supposed to do it alone. You're supposed to talk to your doctor first. But what if your doctor never really existed? Or worse, what if the only person who ever spoke to him was your husband? The morning after I poured that pill into the soil, I woke before the sun. Not like usual, not the groggy, half-hungover haze David said was part of the adjustment period. No, this was different. My eyes opened like they belonged to someone else. Clear. Alert. Focused. For the first time in what felt like years, the fog didn't settle in immediately. The world didn't tilt sideways. My thoughts didn't feel like they were drowning in wet wool. Instead, the silence around me was crisp. The air smelled like earth. The plant beside the couch, an overwatered ficus I'd almost killed months ago, had taken on a faint sour smell from the dissolved pill. I leaned in and inhaled again. There it was. Chemical. Bitter. I'd trusted him. God, I had trusted him. All those nights I thought I was losing time. All the times I cried in his arms, asking what was wrong with me. All the times he held me and whispered, "You're okay, baby. I've got you." I used to think he was my anchor. But now I wasn't so sure he wasn't the storm. I sat there for a long time, unmoving, while the house slowly came alive around me. The refrigerator clicked. The thermostat hummed. The birds outside chirped like they were mocking me with their certainty. At 6:17 a.m., I heard the stairs creak. David. I didn't look at him as he walked into the room. I could feel his eyes on me, scanning. Calculating. "Did you sleep?" he asked, yawning, stretching as he came closer. "You weren't in bed when I woke up." I smiled faintly. "Came down early. Thought I'd start the day slow." He came around behind me and pressed his lips to my temple. His stubble scraped lightly against my skin. "You didn't finish your medication last night." I looked up at him. "Did I forget again?" A pause. "Just a beat too long." "Yeah," he said finally. "But it's okay. You were tired." His hand was already reaching for the drawer. The one I'd left exactly as I found it, untouched but no longer unseen. I watched, expression soft, while he took out the morning bottle and shook a pill into his palm. He handed it to me with a glass of water. I took both. Smiled again. And this time, I palmed the pill like a magician doing a cheap trick at a child's birthday party. I'd practiced the motion in my head all night. Thumb pressure, index support, pinky cover. My fingers closed around the pill so smoothly it scared me. David stood there, watching. He always watched. I tilted the glass. Drank the water. Sighed. "There," I said. "Good girl, right?" He chuckled, kissed my forehead again. "That's my girl." And just like that, the ritual was complete. He went upstairs to shower. I went to the bathroom, locked the door, and spat the pill into a tissue. Flushed it. Washed my hands. And stared at myself in the mirror for a long time. Who was I? The woman in the mirror didn't look crazy. She looked tired. Sharp. Hollow in a way that made her eyes darker than I remembered. I press my fingers to my face, watching the skin give and then spring back. For a moment, I wondered what would happen if I was crazy. If all of this, the drawer, the vanishing time, the missing hours, was just a symptom of a deeper sickness. Maybe David was right. Maybe I was broken. But then I remembered the drawer, the missing prescription labels, the fact that David was the only one who ever handled my pills, and something else, something smaller, something that had nearly slipped past me last week. The voicemail from a doctor's office I didn't recognize. Hi, Mrs. Maddox. We're calling to confirm your follow-up with Dr. Larson next Thursday at 10:45 a.m. David had deleted it, but not before I'd heard the first 5 seconds. And when I asked him about it, he said it was an old message. A mistake. He'd brushed it off with a wave and a kiss and told me not to worry. But I had worried, and now I knew why. I needed to find that number. But first I needed proof. Not just of the pills. Not just of the gaps. I needed to know what David was doing at night. Where he was going. What he was saying. What he was planning. Because the way he looked at me sometimes, too gentle, too calm, too controlled, made something deep in my stomach coil like a snake. And the way I kept waking up in different places than I fell asleep, that wasn't normal. That wasn't medication. That was manipulation. I stayed downstairs the rest of the morning. Pretended to read a book while my mind spun in endless, dizzying loops. I needed a plan. So I made one. Step one, stop taking the pills. Completely. No tapering. No pretending. Step two, gather evidence. Photographs. Samples. Video if I could get it. Step three, call Dr. Larson. Find out if he's real. If he's seen me. If my name is even on his books. Step four, wait. Watch. Listen. Learn. Step five, leave. If I still could. David left for work at 9:23 a.m. after giving me my second dose of medication. I took it, kissed him goodbye, then locked the door behind him and immediately ran upstairs to the guest room. The office. The one place I'd never been allowed to linger too long. I opened the drawer of his desk. Bills. Receipts. A ledger of sorts, expenses in one column, dates in another. Medical appointments. Weekly. All in his name. I checked the closet. Nothing unusual. A few old suits. Boxes. Then I saw it. The air vent. Covered with a newer-looking grill. Screwed in tight. But the screws were loose. Sloppy. One of them had dried glue on it. As if someone had taken it off and reattached it quickly. I pulled it free. My hands shook. Inside was a small black box. A camera. Tiny. Wireless. Recording light blinking red. I stared at it. Frozen. He was recording me. I checked the angle. From where the vent sat in the corner of the ceiling, it had a perfect view of our bed. Of me. Sleeping. Vulnerable. Unaware. My stomach turned. My vision tunneled. I sat down hard on the floor, holding the camera in my lap like a dead bird. This was bigger than pills. Bigger than blackouts. David was watching me. Not out of love, but out of something colder. Something darker. Something that pulsed beneath the surface of his every sweetheart, and take your meds, and I just want what's best. He wasn't helping me. He was hunting me. Chapter 3 playback. People always say the camera doesn't lie. But I've learned that's not true. The camera doesn't lie, unless someone tells it how to. That little black camera I found inside the guest room vent? It wasn't just a spy. It was a storyteller. A collector of moments real and staged. A witness to things I couldn't remember, or maybe was never meant to. When I held it in my hands, heart pounding so loud I thought it would shatter the glass desk lamp beside me, I had one overwhelming, nauseating thought. What else has he seen? Not just the sleeping. Not just the tossing and turning and drooling in the dark. No. Something else. Something worse. I had to find out. But first, I had to make sure I wasn't being watched right now. I checked every corner of the office. The bookshelf. The ceiling tiles. The desk drawers. I found nothing new, at least, nothing with a lens. Still, the air felt crowded. Like something unseen was pressing down on me, watching through invisible eyes. Once I was certain as anyone could be in a house like mine, I plugged the camera's receiver into David's old laptop. It was one of those clunky things he said he'd only kept for tax documents. Password protected, of course. But I knew my husband. He used the same password for everything. Our anniversary. 0726 Maddox. I typed it in with fingers that barely felt like mine. The screen blinked and opened. There were folders. Dozens of them. Some were named boring things like 2021 underscore taxes and vehicle underscore records. Others had numbers and dates. But there was one folder in particular that made my mouth go dry. ES underscore state. I clicked. Inside videos. Timestamps. One every night. Going back 6 months. I opened the most recent. And I saw myself. Lying in bed. Tossing then still. Then twitching, just slightly, like my limbs were moving without permission. My eyes fluttered. My mouth opened. I mumbled something. I couldn't make it out. The audio was faint. Then at exactly 3:12 a.m., the same time the clock had blinked red last night, David walked in. He moved carefully, calmly, wearing gloves. He leaned over me, whispered something in my ear, then reached into his pocket. He opened my mouth, and he dropped a pill onto my tongue. I flinched back from the screen. The moment replayed in my mind like a cracked record. Over and over. Him, leaning in, dropping the pill, wiping his gloved fingers on a towel. I opened another video. From a week ago. Same time. Same routine. Same pill. Another. 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 Every single night, like clockwork. He wasn't just drugging me with my knowledge, he was drugging me without it, too. A two-pronged approach. The prescribed medication to keep me compliant during the day. And a secret midnight dose to knock me down even further. This wasn't care. This wasn't treatment. This was control. He was engineering my collapse. I watched until the room swam and my eyes burned. Until I couldn't tell which version of me was real. The one on the screen or the one sitting hunched in a chair, trembling like a live wire. Eventually, I closed the videos. Not because I wanted to, but because I couldn't breathe. I stood, walked to the hallway mirror, and stared at myself again. What was he trying to do? Make me forget? Or make me remember something he didn't want me to? A memory flickered, brief and broken. Me, screaming, crying, in the kitchen. Something shattered on the floor. David trying to calm me down, his voice low and patient. My words slurred, erratic, frightened. I'd always believed it was me unraveling. But what if it wasn't? What if he'd started the fire, then handed me a bucket full of holes? What if every episode one ever had was planted? I needed answers. Real ones. Not the kind he spoon-fed me with a pat on the head and a glass of water laced with God knows what. And I knew exactly where to start. Dr. Larson. The name from the voicemail. The supposed psychiatrist David had taken me to so many times. But I couldn't remember any of those visits. Not the office. Not the man. Not even the building. I pulled out my phone and typed his name into the browser. There he was. Dr. Alan Larson, licensed psychiatrist, practicing out of a quiet office park downtown. I called the number listed. My hand was shaking so hard I almost dropped the phone. The receptionist answered. Dr. Larson's office, this is Kayla. Hi, I said, trying to keep my voice steady. I was just wondering, could you tell me if I have an upcoming appointment? Name, please. Elena Maddox. A pause. A keyboard clicking. She said. Let me check the inactive files, just in case you're archived. More clicking. Then. I'm sorry, ma'am. There's no record of you ever being a patient here. My blood turned to ice. Are you sure? I whispered. Yes. Positive. We've never had an Elena Maddox in our system. But my husband, David Maddox, he said he brought me there. Multiple times. We don't have anyone by that name either. I thanked her. Hung up. And sat in stunned silence for a full 10 minutes. There was no doctor. Or, at least not for me. That voicemail? Probably a trick. Fabricated. One of David's recordings, timed to play at the right moment, to support the illusion. My hands were still shaking when I returned to the laptop. There was one more folder I hadn't opened. Sessions. I clicked. The videos here were different. They were recordings of me. Sitting in a chair. Answering questions. Rocking slightly. Staring into space. But the man's voice behind the camera? It was David, pretending to be a therapist. Tell me more about the voices, Elena, he said, his voice lowered, disguised, but unmistakable. I don't remember, I said on screen. Sometimes I hear things, but I don't know what's real anymore. That's okay, he said. We're going to get you better. You trust me, don't you? Yes, I whispered. My voice broke on the video. I watched 5 of those sessions. Different clothes. Different days. Always the same chair. Always the same setup. Always David just out of frame, controlling the dialogue. He'd built a record of my instability. To show who? Authorities? A lawyer? A psychiatrist? A future caseworker? Was he trying to commit me? Was this his plan? Make me disappear in plain sight? Tears streamed down my face, but I didn't wipe them away. I closed the laptop, stood up, and for the first time, I stopped being afraid. Because now I knew what I was dealing with. David wasn't a caregiver, or a devoted husband, or a loving partner trying to help his fragile wife get better. David was a puppeteer, and I was just another marionette. But not anymore. No more pills. No more games. No more smiling and nodding while he whispered lies into my food and called them medicine. If he wanted a performance, I'd give him one. Starting tonight. Chapter 4, The Performance. It's easier than I thought it would be. Faking madness. All you have to do is let people see what they expect to see. Tilt your head the right way. Leave your sentences unfinished. Blink slowly like your thoughts are dripping down the back of your throat instead of spilling out. You don't even have to lie. Just stop correcting them when they lie for you. Let the silence fill in the blanks. Let them believe it. David came home late again last night. His tie askew. His cologne heavier than usual, like he'd been somewhere he shouldn't. He kissed my cheek, asked how I was feeling, and set down a paper bag full of takeout from a place I hadn't heard of. "You were sleeping so soundly when I left this morning," he said gently. "Didn't want to wake you." "Thanks," I mumbled, forcing a slow, dazed smile. I think I needed the rest. He beamed at that. Beamed, like I was a good dog who'd finally stopped barking. I let him pour me a glass of water. Let him hand me the morning pill. Even though it was well past 7 p.m., and I slipped it under my tongue with the grace of someone well-practiced in betrayal. He watched me, of course. He always does. Like he's waiting for the illusion to crack. Like he expects me to lash out or scream or accuse. But I've learned something important. He doesn't know what to do with quiet compliance. The absence of resistance throws him off. He expects chaos, confusion, fear. When I give him stillness, it unsettles him. He doesn't know how to dominate silence. So I weaponized it. After dinner, I let my eyes grow glassy. Let my head roll gently to one side on the couch. Let my breath deepen just slightly, as if I were sedated. I answered questions with nods or hesitant, wandering words. I pretended to lose track of the conversation halfway through. And when David leaned over and asked, "Do you remember taking your meds this morning?" I said nothing at all. Just blinked. He murmured, touching my wrist like he was checking for a pulse. "Might need to adjust the dose. You're slipping again." I stared at him, the corners of my lips twitching into the softest smile. One I knew he couldn't read. Let him think I was gone. Let him lower his guard. The moment he went upstairs to shower, I slipped into the office. The laptop was still hidden behind the printer, untouched from where I'd stashed it two nights ago. I didn't risk watching the videos again, I couldn't. Not yet. My stomach still turned every time I thought about them. But I made copies. Loaded the footage onto a thumb drive I'd found buried in the back of the junk drawer. Labeled it wedding photos and taped it beneath the lining of my purse, tucked beneath loose receipts and expired coupons. I also emailed one video to a burner email I'd created in the dead of night. Just in case. Because even if I didn't make it out of this house, someone needed to know the truth. I also needed more answers, more proof. But I couldn't push too fast. Couldn't break character. David was careful. Strategic. Every day was a chess move, and I had to stop thinking like a pawn. So I started playing the long game. The next morning, I made sure to look groggy. I shuffled into the kitchen barefoot, hair unbrushed, wearing one of David's old college sweatshirts I hadn't touched in years. He was already there, brewing coffee. He turned when he heard me. "Hey, you," he said a bit too brightly. "You look tired." I blinked slowly. "I had a dream," I said. "Oh yeah," he handed me a mug. "What about?" I let my eyes drift to the window. "You were driving, and I wasn't wearing a seatbelt." His smile didn't waver. "Sounds like a metaphor." "Maybe." I sipped the coffee. "Or maybe a warning." There. A flicker. Just a flash in his eyes. A shift in posture. But I caught it. He was listening now. All day, I continued the act. I let my sentences trail off mid-thought. Paused before answering simple questions. Stared a little too long at the wall. Once I forgot how to use the TV remote. Handed it to him like a child asking how to turn on cartoons. He smiled, of course. Sat beside me. Walked me through the buttons. But I saw the way he looked at me when he thought I wasn't watching. Not like a man looking at his wife. Like a man looking at a project. A case file. A subject. And I played the role. To perfection. But inside, the thoughts were sharp. Cold. Clearer than they'd been in months. And the more I withheld the medication, the more the fog lifted. Day by day. Hour by hour. my memory returning like fragments of a shattered mirror. Not all at once, just enough to make me dangerous. I remembered screaming. I remembered the night I found my phone in the freezer, turned off, battery removed. I remembered a cut on my arm I didn't know I'd gotten, David telling me I'd broken a glass. But there had been no broken glass. Not that I could see. I remembered the scent of bleach, the sound of dragging, and I remembered the basement, a place I hadn't stepped into in over a year. David kept it locked, said it was just storage. Nothing down there but mold and boxes, he'd say laughing. But the more I remembered, the more the door at the end of the hallway began to haunt me. On the third night of my performance, I waited until David took one of his longer showers, 27 minutes, like clockwork. I crept downstairs, quiet, barefoot. The basement door had a keypad lock, one I'd never had the code to. I tried our anniversary first. Nothing. His birthday. No dice. My birthday. Still no. Then I thought of something darker, something meaner. The day he said I first lost time. October 8th. I punched in 1008. The lock clicked. My breath caught in my throat. I opened the door. It smelled of dust and wet wood, of old air that hadn't moved in months. I stepped inside, carefully, one stair at a time. The light flicked on when I reached the bottom. There was no mold, no boxes, just furniture. A single armchair, a side table, a camera tripod, a roll of duct tape, a whiteboard with names I didn't recognize, and in the corner, covered with a sheet. I pulled it off. A hospital bed, restraints, stain sheets, a tray with old pill bottles, labeled the same way as the drawer upstairs. Morning, night, extra, and a folder, thick, labeled patient file, Yem in David's handwriting. I couldn't breathe. This wasn't storage. This was a set, a place to film me, to stage episodes, to fabricate evidence. And the whiteboard, notes, episode length, 6 minutes and 12 seconds. Try increased dose next time. Too responsive on day 4, reduce water. Introduce auditory hallucinations, 2 a.m. audio loop. I dropped the marker I'd accidentally picked up. It rolled across the floor, the sound loud as a gunshot in the silence. That's when I heard the shower stop. 27 minutes. Time was up. I ran, quiet as I could, locked the basement door behind me, slipped into the kitchen and opened the fridge like I'd been there all along. He came down a minute later. Everything okay? He asked, drying his hair with a towel. I turned. Smiled. Yeah, I said. I was just about to make us tea. Chapter 5, Beneath the Surface. There's a strange power in pretending to be powerless. You begin to understand the art of subtle rebellion. How to play the part so well that even your enemy thanks you for your compliance. How to smile sweetly while you coat the tip of your dagger in something slow. Something that won't be felt until it's too late to stop the bleeding. That's where I was now. Falling with purpose. The days began to blend into each other. Not because I was slipping, but because I needed David to believe I was. The irony didn't escape me. The same man who drugged me to control my behavior now watched eagerly for signs that the drugs were working, that I was becoming more docile, more malleable. He was seeing what he wanted to see, and I was giving it to him. Each morning, I made sure to shuffle more slowly from the bedroom to the kitchen. I kept my eyes slightly unfocused, my speech just stilted enough to raise concern but not suspicion. I had a strange dream last night, I'd mumble. There was someone else in the house. David would freeze, ever so briefly before smiling. Just a dream, sweetheart. He always said that, and I always nodded. But in the background, my mind was awake, whirring, scanning, recording. I began leaving little signs of decline around the house. One day, I put my keys in the freezer. Another, I left the front door wide open and stood outside barefoot in the cold, staring at the sky. David found me and wrapped a blanket around my shoulders, whispering how proud he was that I came outside for some fresh air. He thought he'd broken me so well that I'd now begun to break myself. I let him think that. Let him comfort me. Let him believe I was folding in on myself like damp paper. But beneath the surface, I was collecting puzzle pieces. Building a map. A plan. After discovering the staged treatment room in the basement, I knew the truth. This was never about healing. It was about erasure. He was preparing something permanent. It became clear in the way he hovered just a little too long when I stood near the stairs. In how he now insisted on bringing me my drinks, my meals, my vitamins. How he watched me when I ate. How his eyes flicked to my throat as I swallowed. He was studying me, measuring dosage against behavior, monitoring results. but he didn't know I'd stopped taking the pills. Not a single one had passed my lips since I'd found the drawer. I flushed them, buried them, even fed one to the neighbor's dog when no one was looking. And slowly, carefully, I was getting stronger. Every day, without the meds, peeled back another layer of fog. My memory came back in sharp bursts, not full scenes, but flashes. Snapshots. A bottle of wine spilled across the rug. My own voice screaming into the phone. The heavy sound of footsteps on the stairs when I thought I was alone. One memory stopped me cold. Me, standing in the bathroom. Door locked. Crying silently. Holding a positive pregnancy test. And the feeling that followed, not joy. Not fear. Just urgency. Pressure. Then nothing. The memory ended there. No more clues. No resolution. Where had it gone? Where had they gone? I never had a child. I never got bigger. Never saw a doctor. But I remembered that test. I remembered that pink line. I remembered the weight of it in my palm like a stone. Had I lost it? Or had he taken it? I needed answers. So I gave him a reason to talk. I waited until he brought me dinner that night. A bowl of creamy mushroom soup, fragrant and earthy and slightly too warm, and sat beside me like he always did. I let my spoon shake in my hand, let a drop of soup dribble down my chin. I had a dream again, I whispered, swallowing a spoonful I didn't taste. David reached over, dabbing at my lip with a napkin. Another one? I nodded. There was a baby. His hand froze. I looked at him, right in the eyes. Did we ever try to have kids? He blinked. Just once. A fraction of a second. But it was there. That tiny sliver of unguarded panic. Then he smiled. Oh, sweetheart. We talked about it. You were too sick. It wasn't the right time. That's funny, I said, tilting my head. Because I dreamed I took a test. And it was positive. His smile thinned. You probably saw that in a show. No, I said softly. It was real. I could feel it. He reached out, stroked my hair. You're remembering wrong again, he whispered. That happens when your brain starts creating false memories. It's not your fault. It's the disorder. That word, disorder, snapped something in me. Not because it was cruel, but because he said it like it was a fact. A medical diagnosis. Like it had already been written into my file. Filed under unreliable. Hysterical. Disposable. I took his hand. Squeezed it gently. You're right, I said. I don't know what's real anymore. He relaxed. I smiled. And when he went upstairs to answer a work call, I poured the rest of the soup into the sink and washed the bowl like a good little wife. Then I slipped into the guest room, pulled out the hidden thumb drive, and uploaded the rest of the footage I'd been collecting. I'd been copying more than just the videos from the vent camera. Each night after David fell asleep, I went into the basement with gloves and my phone, and I photographed everything. The restraints, the notes, the timeline of symptoms he'd written on the whiteboard. His version of my descent. His fabricated history of episodes and relapses and violent outbursts. He was building a case, preparing for a disaster of his own design. And if I didn't beat him to the punch, I would disappear beneath the story he had written for me. But now I had a story of my own, one I was carefully crafting piece by piece. I started using his surveillance against him. Each morning, I'd do something just a little off, just a little wrong. Leave the oven on. Pour orange juice into my cereal. Wear my shirt backward. Say the wrong name when I called for him. All of it recorded by the cameras I knew he'd hidden. He was gathering evidence of my decline. But what he didn't know was that I was feeding him that evidence on purpose. I was giving him too much. So much, in fact, that it would look ridiculous to anyone else. Comical. Forced. Staged. Because it was. If he ever tried to present it in court, it would seem exaggerated. Implausible. Contrived. That was the goal. To turn his own gaslighting into a parody of itself. I even wrote a note one day. Scribbled it in shaky handwriting. Left it in my pocket for him to find when he did laundry. He's watching me. He's not who he says he is. Don't trust the food. When he asked about it, I laughed. I don't remember writing that, I said. Weird, huh? David's smile tightened. I could feel the gears in his head turning. He was recalculating. Reassessing. Good. Let him wonder. Let him question me, the way I had questioned myself for months. The day before yesterday, I saw him checking the lock on the basement door. I think he suspects I've been down there. I think he's starting to feel me slip through his fingers, which means the clock is ticking. Soon he'll act. Soon he'll try to tighten the leash again. Maybe with more medication. Maybe with force. Maybe with something worse. But I'm ready. Because while he was busy building a story about my breakdown, I've been writing a new ending. one where he doesn't get to decide how it finishes. Chapter 6, The Unraveling. There's a point in every lie where the thread begins to pull. Not all at once, not in some dramatic collapse, but slowly, silently. One tiny unraveling stitch at a time. A word set out of place. A question asked twice. A hesitation that didn't used to be there. A crack in the voice of someone who used to speak with confidence. David was unraveling, and I was holding the thread. I could see it in the way he watched me now, not with warmth or pity, but with uncertainty. Suspicion, like he wasn't sure whether he was watching his carefully medicated wife or something else. Something aware. For weeks, I'd been planting seeds. Clues that could be explained away but never quite dismissed. A key he swore he left on the counter that went missing. A sticky note he didn't remember writing stuck to the fridge with the words, "It's not safe anymore." The sound of footsteps at night that weren't mine, but that I insisted I'd heard. Every time he tried to steer the narrative, I would stumble slightly to the left, never directly contradicting him, never confronting him, just drifting like a ghost who didn't believe she was dead. It was driving him mad, and that's how I knew I was close. The tension between us had grown taut, nearly imperceptible, but ever-present. It hummed beneath the breakfast table, curled like smoke around the corners of the living room. He hovered more, asked more questions, watched me out of the corner of his eye like I might bolt. One morning, I caught him staring at me while I brushed my hair in the mirror, his reflection behind mine, his face unreadable. "You're quiet lately," he said. "Withdrawn." I met his eyes in the mirror. "You said that's normal. Part of the process." He tilted his head, like he was trying to remember if he had, in fact, said that. "Sometimes," he murmured. "But sometimes it means something's off." I set the brush down slowly. "Do you think something's off?" He paused, just long enough to answer the question with silence. Then he smiled, stepping forward to kiss my temple. "No," he whispered. "I think we're making progress." But the kiss didn't land, and the smile didn't touch his eyes. He knew something was wrong. The problem was he didn't know what. And I wasn't going to give him the luxury of clarity. That afternoon, I went down to the basement again. This time, I wasn't just there to document. I was there to disrupt. I rearranged the props, moved the camera slightly out of alignment, unplugged the white noise machine he used for sound design during his faked episodes, tilted the whiteboard just enough that the marker would smear when he next touched it. Then I unscrewed two legs of the hospital bed. Not so it would collapse immediately. No, that would be too obvious. I loosened them just enough that they would feel unstable. A faint wobble. A whisper of uncertainty. I wanted him to feel it. To wonder. To question the foundation of the world he thought he controlled. Upstairs, I left a file folder of his own notes, printed, highlighted, damning, tucked behind a couch cushion, just barely visible. I watched as he found it that evening. He stood there, holding the folder like it might explode. "Where did you get this?" he asked, his voice too flat. I blinked. "What is it?" He walked over, placed it in my lap. "You don't remember?" I flipped through the pages slowly. "These look like doctor notes." "They are," he said. "Yours. From Dr. Larson." "Who?" His jaw tightened. "Elena," he said softly. "You've seen him every week for over a year." I gave him the perfect amount of confusion. The soft panic of someone who doesn't trust her own brain. I don't remember." "You don't have to," he said quickly. "That's why we keep records." And just like that, he thought he'd regained control. But I watched his hands as he put the folder away, shaking. He was afraid, because if I had gotten it myself, then the door wasn't just ajar. It was wide open, and I was standing on the other side, staring back at him. The next night, I let myself slip further, on purpose. I let him find me in the kitchen at 3 a.m., barefoot, holding a knife, just standing. The light from the fridge cast a cold glow across the floor. My face was blank. He froze in the doorway. "Elena," he said softly. I blinked. "Slowly. I was looking for something," I whispered. He moved cautiously. "You should be sleeping." "I was." A pause. My voice barely audible. But then I remembered. "What did you remember?" I looked up at him. "You put something in my food." He stepped closer. Smiled gently, but his voice was tight. "No, sweetheart. We've talked about this." "No," I said louder this time. "We haven't. You always say we have, but I never remember. And I don't think it's me. I think it's you." A long, brittle silence. Then, with the patience of a practiced manipulator, he stepped forward and took the knife from my hand. "Let's go back to bed," he said. "You're exhausted." I let him lead me upstairs. Let him tuck me in. Let him believe he'd won. But I didn't sleep. I laid there in the dark, eyes open, heart racing, waiting for the inevitable shift. Because that confrontation had been a risk, a test, and now I had my answer. By morning, the shift had come. I awoke to the sound of a car engine idling outside. When I looked through the blinds, I saw a man standing at our front door, dressed in slacks and a neutral-colored jacket, holding a clipboard. David was speaking to him on the porch. He was smiling, too widely. I couldn't hear what they were saying, but the man nodded a lot, took notes, glanced up at the house like he was trying to assess something invisible. An hour later, David brought me tea. I stared at it. "Drink it while it's warm," he said. "You'll feel better." I took the cup, but didn't drink. I knew what this was. A check-in. He was laying the groundwork, positioning me as a danger to myself, paving the road for the next phase. Maybe he'd have me evaluated. Maybe committed. Maybe something worse. He thought I didn't know, but I was already ahead. That night, I searched his study and found a printed letter in a manila envelope addressed to Dr. John Faulkner. I recognized the name from the clipboard. The letter said, "Per our previous conversations, I am formally requesting a private in-home evaluation of my wife, Elena Maddox, citing concerns of delusional behavior, frequent memory loss, and paranoia. Enclosed is a selection of supporting documentation and recent footage." Footage. He was still recording me, but I was recording him too. I had my own cache now, my own collection. Videos of him prepping pills, of him whispering to me while I slept, of him staging disoriented scenes, of him practicing lines in the mirror over and over until they sounded effortless. I was building my own case, not just for the truth, but for justice. It wasn't enough to escape him. Not anymore. He had to fall. And if I was going to do that, I needed him to trust me completely, one last time. So I played my final card. That night, I crawled into bed beside him and whispered, "I think I'm ready for help." He rolled over, startled. "You are." I nodded. "I want to feel better. I'm scared." He took my hand, kissed it. "You're doing the right thing." His eyes gleamed with victory. He thought I was giving in. But really? I was giving him the rope. All he had to do now was hang himself with it. Chapter 7, The Final Dose. There's a sound that comes before something breaks. It's not always loud. Sometimes it's just a silence that stretches too long. A breath held too tightly. A floorboard creaking one step too many. In my case, it was a spoon clinking too hard against porcelain. That morning, I stirred honey into my tea. Slowly, rhythmically. David sat across from me at the table, pretending to read the paper. But he wasn't turning the pages. He was watching me from behind the words. He knew. Not everything, but something. He'd begun to suspect. It started with the missing pills. The ones I'd stopped taking weeks ago. Then it was the expressions I couldn't quite hide. The way my eyes stayed focused, how my sentences stopped drifting, how I'd begun to hum while I cleaned, light on my feet, movements fluid. Sanity doesn't wear a mask well. It slips through. Shines. And now, David was squinting into the light of it. "I've been thinking," he said casually, folding the paper and setting it aside. "About us. About how far we've come." I looked up. "Yeah," he nodded. "I think you're ready for something stronger. Long term. Not just pills. A solution." "What kind of solution?" He smiled, but it didn't reach his eyes. "One that ensures your stability. Permanently." My stomach turned. There it was. The moment I'd been waiting for. The quiet threat disguised as concern. He'd spent months building the narrative of my decline, scripting my madness, documenting my episodes with footage, notes, even forged session tapes. And now he was ready for the final act. Something irreversible. Something that would erase me completely. A locked ward. A fabricated diagnosis. A carefully crafted report from a psychiatrist who didn't exist, or one who owed him a favor. Or worse, something that didn't involve doctors at all. An accident, maybe. He'd mentioned something in one of those tapes. I remembered the words clearly. "If she falls down the stairs, no one questions it. Especially if the symptoms have been documented for months." I smiled at him now. "You always know what's best for me." He smiled back. "That's why I take care of you." I waited until he left for his morning run. The one he took every Saturday like ritual clockwork. Always 25 minutes. Always the same route. He never suspected that routine could become a weakness. As soon as the front door clicked shut, I sprang into action. I went to the office first. Pulled the thumb drive from its hiding place and slid it into my pocket. Then to the kitchen, where I grabbed the tiny vial I'd swiped from his basement stash, the one labeled Sleep-Induced Trial 2, High Dose. I'd found it hidden in the false back of the locked cabinet, stored with surgical precision. He'd used it on me before, but this time I was using it on him. I crushed the contents into powder and stirred it into the second mug I'd made. His usual, black tea with oat milk, two sugars, always at room temperature. Then I waited. When he returned, sweat clinging to his temples, breath shallow but even, I had the tea ready. "Welcome home," I said brightly, handing him the cup. He blinked, surprised. "You made me tea? You take care of me," I said softly. "Let me take care of you." He took it without question. And that's how I knew he still thought he was winning. We sat in silence as he sipped. I watched every swallow like a countdown. 10 minutes passed. 15. At minute 20, his eyelids began to droop. "Wow," he murmured, setting the cup down. "That hit harder than usual." He tried to stand. Didn't make it. He collapsed onto the couch, arms twitching slightly. Not violently, just enough to be alarming, enough to make him aware that something was wrong. I knelt beside him. "David." His eyes fluttered open. Wide. Panicked. His mouth moved, but no words came out. "You always said I couldn't be trusted with the truth," I whispered. "But you were wrong." I lifted his hand, limp, heavy, and pressed it against my chest. I remember everything now. I stood, moved across the room, and pulled the laptop from its hiding place. Opened the folder he thought I didn't know about. Clicked on the video titled EL_Maddox_Accident_Prep. His face appeared on the screen. "Calm. Focused." He spoke into the lens. "Patient is exhibiting signs of increasing disassociation. A plan has been established in case of injury or escalation." I turned the screen so he could see it. His own voice filled the room. "You were so proud of this setup," I said. "The footage. The timeline. The version of me you were building." I pulled out my phone. Began recording. "Say hi to the camera, David," I said sweetly. His eyes widened. He tried to speak, but his tongue was thick, uncooperative. His body had slumped against the arm of the couch. "You always said I was losing my grip on reality," I continued. "But the truth is, I wasn't the one clinging to lies." I walked to the kitchen, opened the basement door. The keypad still blinked from the last time I'd opened it. I took the camera from its stand, the whiteboard with his notes, his journal, his backup drives. All of it came upstairs. I laid it out on the floor in front of him like a morbid exhibit. "You wanted me erased," I said. "Instead, I'm going to make sure your truth is the one that vanishes." I stood over him, watching his chest rise and fall slower, slower. "Don't worry," I said softly. "You're not dying. That would be too easy." I knelt again, bringing my face close to his. "You're waking up into my story now. You're the one who won't be believed." I reached for his phone, unlocked it using his fingerprint, and began typing a series of messages. To his colleagues. His sister. The private doctor I'd discovered on one of his contacts' lists. The one who charged in cash and didn't ask questions. Messages he would never remember sending. Paranoid. Rambling. Confessional. Just enough to cast doubt. Just enough to raise eyebrows. I planted the evidence. Uploaded the footage to a secure drive. Sent copies to an anonymous inbox I created for every worst-case scenario I could imagine. And then I called 911. "My husband collapsed," I said breathlessly. "He's conscious but confused. I think he's overdosed." It took 10 minutes for them to arrive. When the paramedics carried him out on a stretcher, I was already rehearsing the role I would play. Worried wife. Shaken. Tearful. But grateful. They asked if he'd taken anything. I told them about the stress, the pressure, the pills he'd been hoarding. I gave them the bottles from the drawer, the ones I'd secretly replaced with crushed vitamins. I gave them exactly the performance he'd spent months refining in me. Only this time it was mine. David was admitted for observation. Within 24 hours, I was contacted by a hospital social worker. "I'm so sorry you've been through this," she said gently. "From what we've gathered, your husband may have been struggling for longer than anyone realized." I didn't cry, but I made my voice shake. "I tried to help him," I said. "I know you did," she said. "You're very brave." Brave. That's what they called survivors now. 2 days later, I was granted access to the house to collect my belongings. The police were still reviewing the discovery of his hidden files. The detective assigned to the case, a tired man with eyes that had seen too much, told me quietly, "If even half of what's on that drive is real, he's in deep." I nodded, but didn't say anything else. I didn't have to. because David had taught me everything I needed to know about silence, about performance, about the power of suggestion. He told me I was crazy. I believed him, but not anymore. Now he was the one in the locked room. Now he was the one no one believed. And me, I walked out of that house. Our house, with my head held high, the sun on my face, and the first real breath in my lungs in what felt like years. I am not broken. I am not lost. I am not yours. Not anymore.